haven't signed up, there's a sign-up sheet over here in our email. And how many people, this is your first time here? Okay. Good. So did you find out from email, from website? And what, advocate? Yay. Anybody see us in the preview? No. Website, people?
I'm friends with Dan.
Friends, that's good, good. Keep pulling them in.
And Hampshire Life?
Anybody?
So what's the mystery? Where are the new people?
Where are the new people from? How'd you find out about us?
My wife.
Your wife? Aha. That's good.
Yeah. His wife, I think.
Yeah. Oh, all the way to Antioch. Great. Super. Thank you. You can take some flyers with you and put them up. Okay. Anybody else? The webs? Good.
Bulletin and
arrows. Great. Okay. It's good for us to know sort of where people are finding out about us. Good. We do have a $10 donation, please, if you can. If you can't, that's fine, but it helps us on many things, our websites. Maybe eventually we can bring in somebody from somewhere far away, some famous analyst that you all know. And so please help us. And if you want to give us extra, that's okay, too. And we do not have a break tonight. We just go straight through. So if you need a bathroom, there's a bathroom right there. It says men, but don't worry about it. This is Smith, so it doesn't matter. That always gets a good laugh. Okay. And if you do have somewhere to put it up, far away from here because we can't get around too far, please put up a brochure. Take a brochure and put it up. And we always have flyers for the lecture following, so this is the flyer for next month. I'll tell you about that. So please help us distribute them if you're up in the hill towns or Antioch or the college, because we don't know where to put them up. So, okay, if we have a book group, Memories Against Reflections, how many people would be interested in another book group, maybe on the Red Book? Anybody interested in the Red Book? Mm-hmm. How about Von Franz's the DVDs, The Way of the Dream? That's another one we thought about. Okay. How about Man and His Symbols by Jung? Okay. So we hope to next semester have another book group, but it's not a book group run by an analyst. It's a book group that's a discussion group. We read together and then we talk about it. It's not come and listen to somebody talk about Jung. So it's been really wonderful. We've had two book groups, right? And the discussions have been really very deep. And I had to cancel my Act of Imagination workshop a couple Saturdays ago because I got sick. So if you're interested in Jung's method of Act of Imagination, which was his preferred method, there's a little paper you can sign, just so I have a sense, might have a sense of if people are interested in something like that. Okay, and afterwards, we usually meet, and we will tonight, at the where you have a salon. You just have a cup of tea and talk further at the Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street. Everybody know where that is? Sort of Academy of Music, take a left, and it's about three-quarters of the way down the block. So join us for a cup of tea. I know it suddenly got dark, so everybody's like, I have to go to bed now. I'm going to bed at 8:30. It's like, what? But if you can come and have a cup of tea, it's really fun. So next month, we'll have Bear Green, who's a local analyst, one of our wonderful wise, well, I don't know about that, but he's going to give us a lecture. It's on psychic transformation and the analytic process. And this is the flyer for it, if you will help us put it around. And so that's in December. And then I'll be doing January on an introduction to alchemical symbolism on Sunday. So tonight we have Penelope Tarasuk, who is also a local analyst in South Deerfield. And she's giving our talk, the favorite subject of everybody, which is dreams. and accepting Psyche's gift, The Dream. And I know Penny from different ways. She was the curriculum coordinator for the Boston Jung Institute, where they train analysts and have auditors also. And she was on the training board for 5 years. And she was the third person to graduate, right? First person to graduate from the Boston Jung Institute. That deserves an applause.
Yay!
Okay. And the other thing I know about Penny is she's very sensitive, she's very deep, and she knows the material from the inside out, which we like to have analysts speak, because then that comes across in a very deep way. So welcome, Penny.
Okay. I speak very softly, so this is nice for me. Welcome. Can you hear me in the back?
Okay.
Hi, Kim. Good to see you. There's so many people I know and so many people I don't know. There's even a dog here, which is just fabulous. What is the dog's name?
Lyra.
Lyra?
Lyra.
Lyra. Great. They missed the animal talk. what do I want to say to start? I'm not of the academy. I don't like to lecture. So I will tell stories, I will lead you in some movement, I will invite a friend to read something very special from Dante, I will share some dreams that I've worked with a person. Can you hear me over here?
Yeah.
No.
So when you turn it into the
hard.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it feedback. So yeah, let's just make sure. Does that work better?
No.
Put it in the middle.
There's nothing about. So what you're using seems good. There's just probably a volume mic somewhere to turn it
up.
And don't face the speakers.
What?
If you face the speakers, you'll get feedback.
Right. Oh.
So don't turn around.
That meant you. Don't face the speakers. How are you going to do that? Dan?
Yeah.
I think I have my glasses. Okay. Okay. How's that?
Better.
Okay. You'll have to take it off in a minute.
Do you want to go more central?
Do you want to be?
I want to sit down. I'm sorry.
Can you hear me now?
Now I can.
Okay. I will try. The first thing I want to do is, and Hermes whispered to me this afternoon, so what I'd like to do is turn the lights down a little low.
Yes.
And I am going to ask you to stand in your place, and I'm going to ask you to move. I'm going to give you some music. You know, this is a pilgrimage. This, what we're talking about is a journey to the interior. So if it helps you to close your eyes, that's fine. I don't want you to judge yourself or anyone else, but we're going to move for about 2 or 3 minutes, and we're going to move the energy. So let me go turn it on. And just part of this is so that you breathe and that you move, and you'll understand better later.
Thank you.
How's that like for you?
It's fine. No, it's fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, we really need to. I mean, the whole point of all of this is to breathe. Breath is spirit. And if we're not breathing, we can't move the spirit anywhere. It's still pretty bright.
I know, these lights are
keep working with it.
The spirit will be speaking.
No.
Yeah, yay. Okay.
Making it brighter, not darker.
No.
Okay.
One of the principles behind everything I'm going to say tonight has to do with the circulation. The circulation of breath, the circulation of movement, the circulation in your body, the circulation going to your brain so that, you know, our brains wake up. So I thought I'd start with a little story that I think is very important for really working with the unconscious. And I heard this story about 25 years ago from a Vedanta scholar, a Hindu, and it's astonishing I can remember it. So there was once a boatman. Long ago and far away, in a far, far away place, there was a boatman. Very simple fellow. He wore a little loincloth and he had a wooden boat, which was on the shore of a great river. He was a boatman, his father was a boatman, his grandfather and his grandfather, boatmen all the way back. One day, a scholar came. I believe it was a historian in robes, and said, I would like you to carry me across the river. So he did. He rowed him across the river, and the historian, the scholar, told him all kinds of things, and the boatman kind of shook his head and said, well, you know, I never even went to school. So it was really over his head. So he delivered that man. The next person on the shore was, I think it was a mathematician. And he, again, dressed in lovely robes with his books, talked about everything he knew about mathematics, and the boatman said, well, I'm just a humble boatman, and took him across. And so on and so on. And the poor boatman was so humble. And one day, they were all ready to come back, so he brings them all back. And in the middle of the river, the boat sprung a leak. And the scholars, in their heavy robes, with all their books and all their equipment, you know, were yelling at him to bail out, bail out, bail out. And he couldn't go fast enough. And he said, you have to jump in and you have to swim. And, of course, they fell in and they sunk and their books went to the bottom of the sea. And I'm not sure who survived, but the boatman, of course, being a boatman, knew the river, knew how to swim, and was fine. And I tell you this because Jung himself said it over and over. You can study many, many books from all time, from all kinds of people, But when you enter the analytic room, when you really enter this work, you have to put all that aside. And you have to be in the moment, in the present. And then the work begins. So it doesn't matter how many books you've read. What's important is you have to know how to swim in the unconscious. You have to know how to get in the water of life. You have to feel. And so we're all going to be little boatmen tonight. Also, story, I tell you a story because I'm giving you a gift so that you won't stone me or do those sort of things. But it is a gift. I believe stories are gifts, and many dreams are stories, and they are gifts. The subtitle of tonight has the dream in the brochure. It's not here. But the dream came from a client, a patient, who I work with for many years, and if you've heard me speak before, you've probably heard me speak about her. I work with her, she's an artist. I work with her a little over 7 years, and I was invited to be with her when she died. She asked me to help herself and her family through her death. And it was remarkable, holy experience. And I don't know if I've known many people who worked as hard as she did in her analysis. She had fateful illnesses. She had a schizophrenic son. She had many, many profound losses. Hospital in California. When she was 25, she had cancer, a mastectomy, and the hospital, before blood screening, gave her hepatitis B and C. You know, there are many fateful things that happened to her. And her attitude was remarkable. And it's not that she wasn't angry or hurt and all the rest of it, but she was remarkably open to her experience, especially of the unconscious. And we probably work with, over 7 years, maybe 1,000 dreams, you know, altogether. So the initial dream she brought me was, and if you're at all Jungian, you understand how exciting this was. The dream was, there are 6 stones on a cord, and they're all connected. The second image of that night was a monolith coming out of the earth, and it was partially covered. No people, no anything else, just these inorganic, well, they really, for me, you know, among other things, it was the Philosopher's Stone waiting, you know, to come to life. So that's where it began. And I won't go into all her associations, but I will tell you that at about 18 months into her treatment, she had this dream. I have found an exceptionally wonderful place where pilgrims come to reap the benefit of the waters. I think all Jungian analysis or deep therapy, it's a pilgrimage. It's a pilgrimage to your internal life, and it's a pilgrimage to the soul and of the soul. And the soul needs us as well as we need it, if it's an it. So in the brochure, I said that dreams help guide us during the first half of life to slay, or more likely, to banish the dragon of unconsciousness, to leave home, to leave mother. We need to establish ourselves in the outer world. We need to mate and love. We need to work and play. And we may have glimpses of the numinous as well, through love and sex and birthing and athletics and nature and the arts, religion, and maybe drugs. But we have these glimpses in the first half of life. For sure, we have these glimpses. They're available to many people. In the second half of life, we have to tend the inner marriage within ourselves, the conunctio, that is the joining of the opposites within ourselves. And it's not always just the masculine and feminine aspects, but it's the opposites in any way, shape, or form. We need to be able to hold the opposites and hold the tension, and it's out of the tension of that and not acting out either end that the third rises. Something mysterious, something new can come out of that capacity to hold the opposites. And it's in the second half of life that we begin to surrender our heroic attitude of the ego complex. And we begin to let go of our reliance on the material world. Dreams help us develop our symbolic life, our relationship to the numinous, the power of the all-encompassing self. It leads us to greater meaning. And dreams can help us complete our lives. So tonight, let's see what I have here. I'm going to talk a little about the development of the ego, the hero's journey. Then I'll talk more about midlife. And how many of you would consider yourselves in midlife or beyond?
Well,
I knew it. I knew it. This is your place. And I want to talk a little about ancient incubation and modern psychotherapy, the roots of psychotherapy, and the gift that's bestowed upon us and the necessity of circulation of the gift. Then I'll touch on psyche-soul guides or psychopomps. Might be angels, might be human-type people, might be gods, might be teachers, might be angels, very likely could be animals. And one thing I want you to keep in mind is that no development is linear. And whenever you're dealing with life, it's more of a spiral. You know, we deepen in a spiral and we return to work on unfinished issues, and it doesn't really stop. It goes, we go up and down. We're never really finished. I'd like to say something. I love to use the images, but at the same time, it makes me use my left hemisphere, so I get a little tangled up because I'm so right hemisphere dominant. But I also want to say that the deity that's most connected to the internet and technology is Hermes. Electricity, speed, quicksilver, amoral. Hermes is the deity of the World Wide Web. And so I am aware of that. So I think it's a constant sort of trickery that I'm always tangled up in this stuff. So I want to say a little more about our development. In the first half of life, and I'm going to include the uterine world, because I think we're flooded with our mother's hormones. I think we're flooded with all kinds of things from the outside world when we're in the uterine world. I think as the fetus grows, as we grow inside the uterus, we're very much affected by our mother's moods and life and food and whether she's using alcohol or drugs or smoking or ill or has an accident. The fetus is affected. And we forget, but the experience of labor and delivery is, for all of us, an initial matrix, an initial, one of the most profound threshold experiences all of us will have, all nonverbal. And that is in ourselves. And we don't think about it very often, but it's in us. And it is probably, I don't know why Jung and some of the other people weren't particularly interested in this. Otto Rank was interested in birth trauma, which was very advanced for, you know, for his time. But I am aware that the matrix of experiences for the baby in the process of labor and delivery, there's a way in which that's laid down so cellularly that I think that actually comes back in many ways as we approach major transitions in our life, and particularly death. In other words, fears, particularly fears, as we approach major transitions, particularly bodily ones. So I don't want to underestimate that for any of us, and we were all there. So then there's babyhood and toddlerhood and preschool, if you're lucky, preschool, I think. School, adolescence, and early adulthood to about age 35 to 40. This is the time of the root of basic attachment. This is when that's grown. And it's so critical. That initial relationship, whoever your caregiver is, maybe it's a mother, maybe it's a nanny, maybe the father is acting as the mother, but that initial attachment follows you your whole life, and it will show up over and over in your experiences of intimacy. It will show up when you come into therapy and you have a relationship with your therapist. It is, again, it's like a matrix or a template behind your capacity for relationship. This is a time of great development emotionally, especially the development of the affects of the self. And dear Anita Green speaks deeply and many times about the affects of the self, which are extremely important for all of us. And these are in the early life, particularly preverbally, those are all based in the right hemisphere, and it's directly connected to the ancient limbic system in our brain, nonverbal experience. And the full brain with the left hemisphere doesn't really come online, so to speak, until we're about 4 years old and we're starting to really language more. But if you think about the profundity of that, up until somewhere around 3 to 4, and I'm sure we're each a little different, we are swimming in the affects of the self. We're growing exponentially in all domains. Our brain doesn't even reach its full development till about age 20. And again, I think there are individual differences. I don't think we understand that very much yet. So this is when the matrix of relationship patterning and relating with our own kind, our kinship, this is when that is all happening. Literally, neurologically, we're building all this into memory. And it all is back there in a nonverbal place, and it comes out in our relationships. We experience and build patterns of communication, verbal and nonverbal, and we begin also to construct unconscious ways of self-defense from the outside world, which may be dangerous, but also against our own internal anxiety. Perhaps we have abandonment issues. You know, ideally, we're all securely attached to our caregiver, our mother, more often. But most likely, we're insecure. I think about 50, maybe 50%, I think they'd say, is secure attachment. But my experience is a lot of people have some very basic insecure well, that they're basically insecurely attached, but you can work with that. You can, the brain can change, and we can learn attachment. They've now proven that actually psychotherapy and I'm sure analysis actually changed the brain. So we're still plastic, but we have work to do. This is the time that we are practicing and learning about how our body and the material world interact. We're practicing and experiencing decision making. We're building our ego. I want the red one, not the blue one. I'm hungry now. I'm not hungry now. But every decision we make actually is building our ego and our sense of being secure in our own self. We're learning and practicing our effect on other people and nature, for that matter, and toys and animals. We're learning our place in the world. So we're slowly coalescing an ego complex, and our personality is slowly integrating. This is the time that we're beginning to make sense and build meaning in the world. And this is when the ego is hero, our knight in shining armor, our Wonder Woman in shining armor and bracelets. And I really want to emphasize armor, because this is when we're building psychological defenses, this first half of life, invisible emotional patterns of behavior to protect us, to protect ourselves. And as we were talking about last night, there and some of us in the group, we need an ego. We need an ego that's integrated and resilient enough to carry us into the world without getting stuck in the unconscious through addictions, through dissociation, through psychosis. We need a strong ego to face the unconscious. The dragon that the hero is battling is the primitive, unprocessed material in the unconscious. It can take the form of the personal mother early on. That may change. It could be the father. It could be the family. We need to separate and differentiate emotionally and move into being initiated into larger communities beyond the family, the school, the neighborhood, the peer groups, the teams, the religious groups, the military, professional groups, political groups, service groups. We keep expanding and we're separating. We need to define ourselves beyond the family, and sometimes we're pushing off and actually pushing the family away at that point. This is a time of taking action, a time of effort and agency. It's an aggressive time, certainly assertive, but it can be aggressive. It's a time of great phallic energy, speaking out, reaching out, expressing in words and arts and demonstrating, moving ourselves in the world. This is a time of horsepower. This is a time of physicality and strength, driving cars, making strong bodies, carrying pregnancies, birthing, carrying babies, groceries, etc. And the lances and the armor are going to help ward the dragon to lanced and armored, we're going after the dragon that's claiming that's guarding the unclaimed treasure in the material world. We're asserting ourselves. We're going after a girl, a guy, a degree, a job, a career, a grant, a rank, a fortune, an exhibition, a prize, a stake of land in the world, particularly the material world. This is the time of searching for a mate, a lover, sometimes raising a family, finding our work in the world, and finding ways to play sports, dance, arts. and perhaps we continue to gather glimpses of the numinous through love and sexual experience, through childbearing, through the arts and athletics, prayer, meditation. Jung spoke of the need for love and work and play in the numinous. Freud spoke of love and work. So, midlife, beginning in the late 30s and going to about age 65, and by the way, it's fully, crushingly real by age 65. This is a great time, the great time, of reflection and taking stock. There's a metaphor there too, of one's material life, external life, our emotional, intellectual, mental, and spiritual life. It's a time, that middle age is a time of more reception rather than necessarily acting upon the world. This is the time in middle age where we're meeting the limits of our external lives. We're meeting the limits of our dreams for how our lives were going to be. The limitations of our bodies. Feeling our aging and changing hormones. Limits in our work and career. Limits in our marriages, our families. And having unanticipated losses, deaths, illnesses, financial disaster, natural disasters, the effects of war and poverty and racism and other social complexities around us. So that's middle age. That's where most of us are. And age 65, we're starting to look at old age, after 65, we're starting to look at older age and old age and death. And this is the time where maturity can move into wisdom or there's stagnation and bitterness. And I'll come back to this and talk more about midlife and the plutonian experience of death and rebirth in a little while. This is the time many people enter therapy. And it used to be long ago that people turned more to religious mentors, to priests and shamans and elders, and that's less true now. If there's severe or early trauma, a person may be propelled far earlier into treatment. Moved by sorrow, depression and loss, or outer forces such as acting out in our school or community, or fateful like illness and accidents. So what I want to say is we spiral in our growth, and if we hit an obstacle or a fated event or an illness or anything like that, we often are sent back to do some really deep work on basic trust of ourselves and of life itself. So does anybody else know the game Chutes and Ladders? Okay, well that is based on an ancient Hindu game called Layla. It's called the game of life. And it's that same idea. You know, you're going along, oh, you're going to hit the ladder and you get to go up, but then you hit the snake and I don't know which way it goes, but that's the point, is we go up and down. And rarely do people go through life without obstacles. And we may fall and fail and suffer, but we also learn to reintegrate. And hopefully if you need help, you get help. And not only can you strengthen your ego and your sense of basic trust, but you also, you know, you never lose your experience and you grow. Okay. So I just wanted to say a word about the ego self axis. And I really can't actually say enough, because if there's not a strong enough ego, we can't really connect to the depths of the self. And I find that a number of people come into treatment and they are gung-ho They want to work on archetypes. They want to jump into the ocean. And there's not enough ego, and there's not enough of a relationship built with the therapist analyst. There has to be a good relationship before you go diving into the archetypal world. And some younger people, I remember in the 70s, dove into LSD and other profound experiences or Kundalini yoga, and their ego was eclipsed, and they weren't really prepared to integrate the experiences they had. So, this is an ancient white man. This is Asclepius. And you see the snake over here, and the pole, you know, that's, I think Hermes is often, Hermes Mercury has the caduceus with the twisted snakes, which is a medical symbol. But Asclepius was the original physician archetype. The word psychotherapist is generally used as a descriptive term about psychological treatment. All Jungian analysts first developed through the work of preparing to be psychotherapists in the ancient Greek form. Therapeutes were the attendants who served the god by carrying out the prescribed ritual. And C.A. Meyer, in his lovely little book, Ancient Incubation and Modern Psychotherapy, states, the most famous physician of late antiquity was Galen, and that was 131 A.D. to 201 A.D. Galen styled himself after the therapeute of his fatherly god, Asclepius. Asclepius, the divine physician healer, had appeared to Galen in a dream. And in antiquity, everything had to do with the soul. Everything had to do with the psyche. Everything that had to do with psyche was connected to the soul, and it was embedded in religion. Asclepius embodies the archetype of the divine healer, who gently, and that word is emphasized, it comes up over and over again, gently heals and tends the body and the soul. He invites the patient to seek healing. Asclepius usually appears with his wife, Ippone, and his daughters, Hygieia and Panacea, although they're not in this image. The mother of Asclepius was a mortal by birth, and his father was divine Apollo. He has a very interesting transformative history, a metamorphosis. It's very unusual. He's given by Apollo, after he was born, from this earthly mother, who Apollo kills out of jealousy for some body she was interested in. Anyway, Apollo gives Asclepius to the centaur Chiron, the mortally wounded half-man, half-horse, who's the archetype of the wounded healer. Asclepius is taught the art of healing by Chiron, and at some point he's able to raise a dead human. He can elevate, and he is elevated by the gods to Olympus because he can bring people back to life. He was known for his gentleness and his companions of the snake and the dog and the association with the horse of the centaur. And despite his Olympian status or freedom, he returns to his human roots and practices locally on Earth. He is at the source of the Asclepian mysteries. And Epidaurus was such a place in Greece, and they were built near springs, which were famous for where the snakes came. And that had a history in pagan mysteries. And thonic, the thonic realm, the earthly realm, especially the moist, damp realm, is related to snakes. The patient at Asclepius, at Epidaurus, was tended by a by the therapeutes. They were bathed, and they were prepared to enter the abutan, the sacred sleeping chamber. By the way, they also danced and listened to lovely music. That was it, this was way sooner than Canyon Ranch, which is more the profane. It was here that they would enter the abutan, or the sacred sleeping chamber, and there the incubant, that was the name of the person who came for treatment, the person was there for a healing dream, and especially the agent of the snake or the serpent, which was a form of the self. And in more modern terms, you might think about dreams of the snake actually are related to the reptilian brain, our old brain, which regulates breathing and heart rate and body temperature and other basic metabolic functions. And once a dream was received, the patient was required to find a way to express gratitude for that dream. And one of the main ways was by commissioning artwork, either something in writing or a statue. I believe you could free a slave, but you had to enact gratitude in the form of some kind of art. It was understood that this was an important aspect of the healing experience, circulating the gift which came via the dream. The self-healing capacity of psyche is expressed in dreams and imagination. And I want to just take a moment. I met Chris last night at dinner for the training board, and she was asked sort of what she was motivated by, and she, I mean, you were looking for words, and then she just said, "I want to return the gift." And I thought, that's really what we're talking about. I find that most people come into therapeutic treatment because they are in pain, they're suffering bodily, emotionally, and in soul. The patient brings his suffering or her suffering to the physician. It's usually projected on the physician, on the therapist. In other words, people come in and they often expect the therapist is going to do the healing. So what they're doing is projecting the archetypal physician. And the therapist is part of the ritual and helps create a sacred vessel and hopefully makes a secure base, a secure place for the transformation. And the relationship between the two people is really the critical element. I find that the real meaning in analytic or depth psychotherapy is about the work of dis-ease in the emotional, mental, and spiritual life. And it isn't lost on me that the ritual many medical students go through when they're graduating from medical school is the recitation of the ancient Hippocratic Oath. And Hippocrates lived 460 BC to 375 BC. Above all, do no harm. The doctor's in. The ritual invokes a feeling of sacredness in the practice of medicine. And it's really remarkable to be at a ceremony like that, in modern days, where they literally, all these students stand up and they recite the Hippocratic Oath. Jung said in 1948, that medicine is both an art and a science. No, we're not there yet. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the gift and gifting and the gifted. Lewis Hyde wrote a wonderful little book called The Gift, Imagination and the Erotic Life of Property. The book goes into many things, the anthropology of gift exchange in indigenous cultures. It also talks about the dilemma of being an artist in a very materialistic culture and the problem for artists in how do you both use your artistic gift and earn money from that. So it's a very interesting book. He'd been in analysis with my first analyst, so I've been looking at the book he gave her, which got passed to me. A gift is a thing, a capacity we do not get by our own efforts. We cannot buy it. We cannot acquire it through an act of will. A gift is bestowed upon us. And we can speak of talent as a gift, for although a talent can be perfected by an effort of will, but no effort of will can cause its initial appearance. Mozart, composing on the harpsichord at age 4, had a gift. Intuition and inspiration are gifts. The spirit of an artist's gift can wake our own. A gift revives the soul. When we are moved by art, we are grateful that the artist lived, grateful that she labored in service to her gifts. And this is really important. A gift that cannot be given away ceases to be a gift. So we're back to the concept of circulation. And I also want to say the image of the Ouroboros, the snake biting its own tail. Do you know that image? That's an image of the circulatio, or the grape round, where there's a continuous connection and movement within. The spirit of a gift is kept alive by its constant donation, by its momentum, which also means animation. Animation comes from the core of anima, which is soul. So the cardinal property of the gift, whatever we have been given, is supposed to be given away again and not kept. There's only one really essential rule about gifts, and that they must always move. In this case, if this is the case, then gifts in the outer world must be accepted in the outer world if they are to retain their vitality. The task of setting free one's gifts was recognized labor in the ancient world. The Romans called a person's tutelary spirit, or their protector, guardian, they called that his genius. That is, one's outstanding talent or quality. And in Greece it was called a daemon, or a demigod, guardian spirit, demon. So it was genius and daemon. Is it daemon or daemon?
Daimon.
Thank you. Respected in this way, the genius made one genial, sexually potent, artistically creative, and spiritually fertile. The genius, or daimon, comes to us upon our birth. It simply comes to us. It carries within the fullness of our undeveloped powers, offered as we grow We choose whether or not to accept. We choose whether or not to labor in its service. Genius has need of us. And eventually freedom only through sacrifice. Those who do not reciprocate the gifts of their genius will leave it in bondage when they die. And this is often what we face in late life or even in dying, that somehow we didn't accept the gift and we didn't circulate it. And it's very painful. A gift establishes a bond between two people. It's relational. While the sale of a commodity leaves no necessary connection. And the opposite is properly called narcissism. One who feels his gifts come only from himself, and he works to display himself, and does not suffer change. So I'm going to take a break right here. And Peter? I'm going to hand out a little questionnaire for you to fill out anonymously. Maybe you could share. These are questions that I asked teaching this in Boston. And it's... could I have a copy, please? So if you would just take, you know, 5 minutes and make a few notes. You do not put your name on it. And we will... We will take a little break. So if you would do that and hold on to it. Two dreams are on the back of that sheet. And later I will ask for them back because I'd like the dreams to be left here. So how about at 8:10 we come back and we'll talk about that a little bit? Okay.
There should be enough, and if not, you can share with your manager.
I have extras here.
The extras over here.
How many did you print?
Anybody have a
cat? 50? At least 50 or 60?
Okay.
Wow. And if there aren't enough, then maybe if you could just show the person without one the question.
Any extras from anybody? We're a little short. Anybody else?
If anybody needs to use the restroom now, they can do that too.
Okay.
That'd be me. Thank you. almost ready to talk a little bit about these. How many of you can remember an early or first dream from childhood? You can speak anonymously, or some people aren't so shy, but would anybody like to share one? Can you speak up?
Yep, it was...
And your name is?
Pam.
Pam, hi Pam.
It was a cartoon, and a ton of very small people, a crowd, and a giant chocolate chip cookie that would fall over and crush them all.
Thank you. Anybody else like to share? Yes. Both of you.
I was just about a month ago. I actually ended up telling my mom this, but when I was like 7, and I actually just did the math and realized my dad would have been at like 35 to 40, maybe going from phase 2 to phase 3. I used to have this like repeated dream that he was in a jail cell, and I would show up and kind of bring him food. Mm-hmm. Over and over and over.
Wow.
Yeah. Enough that I can remember it. And it's funny because, like, I'd remember it at certain points and then not remember it. And, yeah. So, actually, I don't know if this is interesting or I should just hush, but... So, I told my mom this. My dad woke up and I was in a certain mood, and I just went ahead and, like, told him and had this awesome conversation with him off the context of that dream and what I thought it meant. So, yeah, it was really powerful.
Yeah. They're very intimate experiences when you share.
Yeah. 30 years later.
It's never too late.
That's what I thought. You know, I was like, this is so cool. Never this is coming up, and you got up, and I got the courage, and yeah, it was really powerful. So.
Thank you. Your name is?
Ilana.
Ilana.
And I'm Anna.
Dan.
And I had an occurring dream of going down a very fast stream, lying under the water, looking up at the sky.
Mm.
Just seeing the clouds go by in the sky, but I was under the water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyone else before we move on? Yes.
My name is Krista, and I think one of my first dreams was when I was around the age of 4, and I would go to visit my grandma in my dream, and there was a triad of these dogs that kind of were situated together, always appeared together, but they were ghosts. They were ghost dogs, and in every room that I would try to enter to get away from these dogs, they would appear again. And they were very beautiful dogs. They were like borzois with like the long, elegant faces because they were haunting.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that very clearly.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes.
So we're sharing first dreams.
Yeah.
My first remembered dream was that I was riding or just sitting on this very large horse that was somewhat phosphorescent.
Mm.
And it had a very toothy smile, the horse. And we were at the edge of a very moss-strewn, algae-like green lake. Everything was very, very green.
Mm.
And when I wrote the dream down, I wrote that the horse's body was bulging with music, opposed to muscle. And it felt really right that it was true. And in the dream, I understood that if the horse was not allowed to drink from that particular lake, that it would start to like freak out, like it needed that specific lake.
Wow. Mm. Impressive.
I'm Andy, and a very early dream that I had was of being attacked by a tiger.
Mm.
Bright orange and striped. And this goes to the second question as well. My father heard me scream and came into the room, and took out an imaginary sword and struck the tiger.
Do you remember how you felt?
Relieved and safe.
Uh-huh. Wow. Thank you. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I just popped in. My earliest dream was that I was in a grocery store with my mother, and a row of tin canned food was between her and I. And I couldn't get to her. I could not get over this wall.
Mm-hmm.
It was a low wall. And I was small.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't. There was, and the grocery store was full of food.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
My name is Mona. As a child, I remember having a recurring dream.
Mm-hmm.
I think I may have had the first one when I was either 5 or 6, till I was about 20. And the setting wasn't anything that I was familiar with, but after I was 20, I experienced that setting. A place that I recognized later. So there was a field, and the field far away had some kind of brook or stream, and up closer the field kind of went uphill. So in the field to the very left in the dream was some kind of bunker that was underground, and inside there were many layers of bumps.
Mm-hmm.
You see,
mm-hmm.
maybe two. But this was a stack, and people were getting inside of those, and inside of the box were these tubes that people would go in to protect themselves.
Hmm.
And when you went out, there were cannons of some kind that would hit people, and people would float past where the cannons were at. The cannons would go through them, and a big hole would come through people.
Mm.
And they would continue running and floating in the air.
Mm.
It was such a strange thing that continued to occur.
Mm-hmm.
But I experienced the field in my mid-20s.
Mm. Thank you. Anybody else like to comment on any other of the questions? Anita.
When I was working in the deepest analysis I ever had, because it was out of my culture, we lived in Zurich with a woman analyst, and I remember in the dream coming into a room, and there was just a plain wooden altar, and I remember going up to it, and then I started, that was pretty much the dream,
mm-hmm.
but then I started kind of what Jungians call active imagination, and I knelt, and I saw behind it a bas relief made out of wood
mm-hmm.
of the three phases of the goddess,
mm-hmm.
the maid, the mother, the crone. And I thought, oh, what am I, I'm kneeling before the archetypal mother. Usually in churches, above the altar would be all men. I mean, like the disciples or something,
mm-hmm.
or some patriarchal scene.
Mm-hmm.
And this was very, very different. And it meant a great deal to me. Yeah.
Thank you. Dan.
You ask here about sharing dreams. It's very convenient to have, as my partner, a Jungian analyst, and it is not at all unusual for us at breakfast to share our dreams and kind of explore them together. I think the deeper issue is that a dream is definitely a gift, and there needs to be some way of honoring the gift, not dismissing it. So sharing it, writing it down, keeping a dream journal, or doing some kind of spontaneous art around the dream, there needs to be some way of giving the dream, which is highly subjective, an objective reality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's part of that circulating the gift.
Yeah.
It's so important. Thank you, Bear. Anyone else? Yeah.
I had this dream that was like amazing, most amazing thing I've ever had, where I was a black woman who was pregnant and I had a kiss.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That
was really beautiful.
Wonderful. You had a dream that you were a black woman and you were pregnant and had.
And
I have breasts and a penis. So there's all kinds of possibilities there. Very fertile. Very, wow. Wow. Well, you know, if you've ever been pregnant with a son, there you are. You actually, your body has created a penis within you, which then, you know, goes along with the little boy out into the world. But I've always found that very astonishing. That it all happens right in this marvelous temple of your body. Any other thoughts or... Yeah.
I had a dream. I just want to say because it seemed really... It's the picture of the water there. It was a dream where I was walking up a hill to a cathedral.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked in the door of the cathedral, and it was all the altars in hand. I took no look. I just went straight down to this spiral staircase of stone, going down, 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 and opened to a huge egg-like room that was had at the bottom a pool of water going down into the earth. There's water like that water. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And on the standing on the side, it was stone. It was all much more crude than this. But on the spiral staircase, it was down in there. It was a naked 56-year-old woman.
And how old are you now?
I am now 68. But this was, you know, 12 years ago.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And it was a huge gift.
Yeah. I find that sometimes some of the most profound gifts come when we're in crisis. And if we have a good relationship with psyche and are dreaming and have the capacity to share dreams, that sometimes dreams will come and help you through that crisis. And it's really a gift because it's like there's an internal resonance with something greater than your own personal life that's in crisis. And I have always found it very, very steadying and confirming and helpful. Yeah.
I've had continuous dreams that are so similar. And I'm always in a very beautiful place, very often on a college campus. I think maybe I'm at Columbia University, or I'm visiting London, or I'm in a foreign place, a different place, and I'm enjoying life very much there.
Mm-hmm.
But then I can't go home. I find I miss the bus, I miss the plane, whatever it is to get home, I always miss it, and I can't find my way home.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's similar. It sounds like other people may have had a similar dream.
Mm-hmm.
I often wake up with a song lyric. Yeah, and I just wondered if anybody else does, because sort of becomes my song of the day.
Would you put your hands up if you've had that sort of music? My goodness!
Wow!
Yeah. I hope you sing it or write it down. Wonderful. Wonderful. Has anybody ever had a dream where they smell something?
Yeah.
Like what?
A barn. a barn. The barn smells.
Okay.
Back a whole experience that I've had.
Olfactory dreams are not as common, I found, and I think they're some of the deepest dreams.
Yes.
So, yes. Someone else had a... Other people with smell?
This was one of the weirder dreams in my life of being brought to a place that was a city that was so old that a river had formed through and was eroding it. It was all made out of black stone, and they're like looking at this city and the water's pouring through, and I can smell the moss on the rocks.
Wow. Beautiful.
I smelled cigarette smoke in the dream.
Mm-hmm. And you know, in utero, by the way, the baby, the smoke is going through the baby's system. I can't say you're necessarily having an olfactory memory, but that smoke, the nicotine, et cetera, is going through the baby. So I don't know. Yeah.
I kind of have this dream that I started off when I was very young. I think it might have been one of the first dreams. And I felt and smelt and saw a lot of different things, but it starts off just darkness, and then I realize that I'm falling from the stars, feeling the earth on my skin, though. Mm. I can feel the stone and sand and granite, but I'm still falling through clouds and sky.
Wow.
And then I see land and trees, and I open my eyes, and I feel the earth and see, like, I must, you know, fly or die. Sometimes I use the trees to jump off of, kind of like springboarding, like a, a big jump. Sometimes I just know that before I hit the ground, I will rise. It's very slow, kind of like a paper airplane with no thrust at first. But eventually I take off.
Well, I encourage people, when they have an important dream, or you can go back and work with a dream that you've already had, to find some way to express it verbally, but particularly non-verbally, in some kind of art form. And in my life, I do a lot of homework. I might do artwork on it. I probably will share it. And sometimes I meditate on it, or I'll take an image from the dream and work with it. This was a collage that I did. I'll just explain that. I had a very, very wonderful series of dreams when I was going through a major crisis of loss. And one of the dreams in the series was of a square marble fountain in the bottom of an ancient building. And there was water pouring. The only sound, it was very, very quiet, and the only sound was moving water coming out of the fountain. And the comfort that that dream brought me was so wonderful. And I started collecting bits of color from magazines and newspapers, and for over a year I did that. And then one day I was at a workshop with Dale Schwartz, wonderful studio, and I did a very explosive collage, you know, and wept and whatnot. And then I realized I need to comfort myself. And I got all this out, and that's actually a photograph from the New York Times when they did a piece, a travel piece on the baths of Bath, England. But I put it together, and what I realized is I created an inner utero world of resting. The feeling I got when I completed it was this sense of utter peace and rest, and it's really a uterine world. But if you notice, it's heaven and earth. It's sort of this combination. And I think that's what we feel when we're growing, that cosmic mother womb. So anyway, it comforts me. any other?
As a child, I did a lot of dreaming and sleepwalking.
Wow.
What is sleepwalking and dreaming? What part of the puzzle is sleepwalking in the Jung approach? Is there?
I don't think I've ever seen Jung write anything on sleepwalking. I really don't know. I don't hear about it very often, but I know it happens. Some people have night terrors in that state. But not, that's a good question. I don't know. I'd also like to say, after I do something like that, then I start to do research on the baths and the waters of Lourdes and try and understand, you know, I just keep doing homework. It just keeps, it's the gift that keeps giving. I also learned that at the, this, what is it, the Shrine of Lourdes, and I believe her name was Bernadette. I think it was Bernadette. She had that experience in her middle age. She died very young, so I figured it out. I think she was around 14. She didn't live very long. But that she had those visions when she was in the middle of her life, interestingly enough. Shrine of Lourdes. Right? So, I appreciate you. I had you do that really for you, just to have you think about your own dream life and to reflect on that for yourself, and I hope you will take that away. So now we have a little more to do. Oh, here we go. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now we're going to talk some about the guides of the soul. And I don't know, I didn't look up where the word psychopomp comes from, but that is such a weird word. But
It means guide of the soul.
Okay. And Hermes, as the archetypal god through all realms, and he's the patron of psychotherapy, according to a number of writers, and Jung thought about it that way. And Hermes is Mercury also, or Mercurius. Animals, especially dogs, birds, dolphins, horses. They show up in dreams. I've worked for over 40 years, and amazing amount of animals come through people's dreams, and they're generally helpful. Sometimes they're threatening, like the tiger. But I suspect that tiger's very important. I have just my intuition said that's a very important tiger, and I would draw it, and I would meditate on it. I might go see a tiger, you know. So, anyway, because there's so much life and instinctual life in an animal, sometimes it's a human psychopomp. I remember having an early dream in my training with the first woman analyst I was with, and it was a taxi driver. And I wanted him to take me somewhere to have an abortion. Now, unfortunately, I'm very happy to say I've never had an abortion in the classic sense, but clearly I was asking him to take me somewhere where I could bring something to death. And he turned around and he looked at me and he said, no. So that's also a guide of the soul. So, and it can be idealize men, women, and spiritual figures. Sometimes their people's spiritual teachers come as a guide. Sometimes it's an anima figure for a man, and it can be anything from a Beatrice, a Sophia, a Mary, prostitutes, little girls, old women. It can be many, many figures. We have our own personal landscape of characters. And I wanted to show you, when I had my initial Jungian interview in Boston, the Boston Institute was literally just formed in 1978, and I had gone into my interview, and that morning I'd had a dream where I was given an ancient tile of a dolphin. So I bring the dream in. I hadn't, you know, worked on it at all, and I remember they were pretty excited about it, and I was told that the dolphin means, Delphus means womb, and I just knew it was a good thing. But it was like a postcard from antiquity arrived the very morning that I was, you know, asking really to be trained. And for me, the dolphin has been a psychopomp, has showed up in various ways through my training, including taking me to an underwater city, the city of Yiz, where people lived below the sea. And the myth that I learned later is that when the feminine principle rises, that city will rise. Wow. So I recommend a new book by Susan Casey called Voices of the Sea, and it's really superb. I didn't think I would like it, but she goes from kind of new age experiences around the dolphin to all the problems in the realm of capturing and killing dolphins, The Cove, the movie The Cove, etc. She really goes there. She goes to the places, she talks to the people, she witnesses. Then she also goes into brain physiology and talks to some of the most outstanding researchers. And dolphins' brains are phenomenal. And I have a feeling we're rivaled, which is good. And then at the end of the book, she goes into the mythology and the archaeology of the dolphin symbol, and she goes to Greece, she goes to the ancient places, and she's allowed into some of the archaeological ruins, and dolphins played an enormous part in the iconography and in the lives of the people. And what she found was that it was a matriarchal culture, and there was no money, and there was a great deal of joy in that culture. But anyway, I really recommend it if you want a kind of a really wonderful study. Susan Casey, and it's called Voices of the Sea. And I think she actually was an editor at Oprah, so I, of course, wasn't going to enjoy it, but I really loved it. I really loved it. So now I have a special treat for you. I'm going to say a little bit, and then I'm going to invite a dear friend to read for us. So Dante's Divine Comedy, the Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso, it starts really in midlife. Midway in life's journey, I found myself in dark woods, the right road lost. To tell about these woods is hard, so tangled and rough and savage that thinking of it now, I feel the old fear stirring. So, Margaret, would you come and read to us? Margaret is one of four wonderful women in the five of your dream group. And would you raise your hands, my wonderful compatriots? And one day, Margaret started reciting this to us. And this is from, you could say, where it came from in your life.
Oh, when I was in high school, we had a wonderful math teacher. This was in Geneva, in Switzerland. And sometimes he saw that we were getting rather bored with trigonometry, and so he would take a break, and he would start reciting the Divine Comedy in Italian to us. And we were studying Italian, but we couldn't really keep up with it. But the rhythm and the sound were so beautiful, and it was a wonderful break from trig. So, this is what Penny just shared with you. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la diritta via era smarrita. Ai, quanto a dir qual era e cosa dura questa selva selvaggia e aspra e forte che nel pensier rinnova la paura. Tante amara che poco è più morte. Ma per trattare del ben che li trovai, dirò delle altre cose che mi ho scorte.
Thank you.
That it goes on.
I had a Swedish analyst for many years, and he was the first Swedish analyst to be trained in the Jungian method, Soren Ekstrom. And he didn't speak English. And he did by the time I was seeing him. But he said he learned English when he fell in love. And he said, if you want to learn something, it should be through love. And it makes it so much easier to learn. So thank you, Margaret, for sharing that little taste. Shortly after that section, Dante pleads. He sees like a shade or a spirit or something, and he said, please have pity on me. And this is Virgil. Virgil says, not a man. I was once a man. I was a poet. It turns out that Virgil, who's going to be his guide, was sent by the three ladies of heaven, Beatrice, Lucia, and Rachel. And they brought blessedness and divine grace, but they sent Virgil to help Dante. And then I learned that Virgil is the very best that can be achieved by man. That is, he was a poet. And remember that in poetry, we use both hemispheres of the brain. We hold the opposites of nonverbal and verbal. And what comes out of that is the third, the creative, the poet, the poetry. And I just love that. And one of the things I learned is that in those days, the poet was considered the highest achievement of a human outside of someone who had experienced a revelation of Christ or Christianity. Am I right? Does that sound right? I'm not a scholar of Dante. So this is Botticelli, and this is Dante and Virgil starting to climb a hill, mm-hmm. and you see the three animals that are encountered very early. Mm-hmm. Lust, pride. Lust is the leopard. Pride, the lion, and the wolf over there was Erebus, or greed. And I'd like to say that, like a lot of experiences, that when we use animals like that, we're really projecting our own human experience onto the animals. It's not so much that the animal is that, but you know, humans have projected on animals for centuries. So, and this is a collage I did early in my analysis, or I'm sure I was working with The Dark Night of the Soul, but you know, there's ghosty people in there, and there's the psychopomp of the what is that, a kestrel or a hawk. There's the regression going down. And this is the figure on the right, the woman with the white face, is in deep grief. And in the back you see the red trauma. I had a lot of trauma, so I've had to do a lot of work in my life, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. I wouldn't change anything. So anyway, that's a dark night of the soul image. I'm only going to talk a little bit about the other psychopomps, but I will read you a little bit. I was given a paper by Richard Stromer called Hermes is God of Liminality and the Guide of Souls. And I'm just going to pull a few thoughts out. Edinger, the noted Jungian author, observes that Hermes, in his role as psychopomp, makes him a divinity of particular importance to those concerned with depth psychology. He's a magician with a magic wand. His ability to cross boundaries makes him a mediator between the human and divine realm. Or, in psychological terms, between the personal psyche and the unconscious depths, so repeatedly crosses the boundary between them and thus assumes the... Depth psychology tries to relate consciousness to the unconscious depths and so repeatedly crosses the boundary between them, thus assuming the functions of Hermes. He's known as a patron saint of depth psychology. Related to the idea of Hermes as a god of the psychic night is his role as the god who brings dreams to sleeping mortals. He sends them dreams, messages from beyond the border of everyday reality that illuminate our experience and bring eternity into time. Hermes, in his guise of bringer of dreams, was also called the Psithistris, a word that still in modern Greek means whisperer, and acknowledges that God taught me to listen with the inner whisperings that tend to get drowned in the mind's cacophony. In addition to bringer of dreams, Murray Stein reminds us that Hermes is the magician who is able to lull our defenses to sleep and to alert them and wake them up in danger. For James Hillman, who dreaming is inherently related to the descent into the from the conscious realm into the psyche's underworld, it's Hermes, thonic aspect from which comes the dream activities. Hermes as bringer of sleep and dreams, and famous as a role of psychopomp, guide of souls of the dead to the underworld. Ancient Greeks kept images of Hermes in their bedrooms and petitioned him to bring them sleep, but not death. It was in his role as psychopomp that Hermes was viewed with the greatest of awe by the ancient Greeks. They viewed him in his role as psychopomp with a sense of awe, and they generally did not fear him. In this guise because of his gentleness with which he performed his terrible task. Christine Downing writes of her own experience, "It is as psychopomp that I've most directly experienced Hermes. In journeying into the underworld, which Hillman advocates as essential for psychic wholeness, we must confront the darker aspects of ourselves from which we otherwise would find ways of ignoring. The task of guiding the soul into the underworld cannot be minimized or omitted from psychology," notes Lopez Pedraza, "because death is death, the always fearful opposite of life, in spite of the fact that our culture has systematically repressed what death is to the psyche. The value of having Hermes as one's companion in the descent to the underworld, rather than Hades or Pluto, is that the psychopomp's role is to guide us in whatever ways are required to learn the lessons which a knowledge of death brings to the living of life. It's important to know and to hear the significance of the deadly side of things. As part of the underworld experience, for example, through contact with our own mortality, we learn that we can never, after all, protect ourselves from having things happen to us, from chance, from surprise, from the god. Hermes divinizes transitions, all transitions, marking them as sacred. And you've heard of the herms on crossroads, the little piles of stone, that was in honor of the crossroads and the god of Hermes. And it marks that every crossing is a threshold, and it's a sacred event. The journey is a rite of departure and crossing over. Hermes' role as guide of souls, his role as guide into and out of those passages in our lives which are inherently liminal between worlds in nature, is the most powerful one. He's particularly relevant in midlife for us. Those are a few thoughts on Hermes, who is the Olympian deity that can travel in all three realms, the underworld, the earth, and in the heavens. He's the brother of Apollo, known as a trickster. He's often associated with amorality, thievery, quicksilver, communications, and he's non-warring, and he can even be humorous. And I wanted to just say something about Philemon. Jung had many guides, and this is a quote from Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. Philemon was the large, angelic man. He's in the Red Book. You can find the picture of him there. Jung painted, I think he was behind his bed. He painted him on the wall behind his bed. Philemon and other figures of my fantasies brought home to me the crucial insight that there are many things in the psyche which I do not produce, but which produce themselves and have their own life. Philemon represented a force which was not myself, and in my fantasies I held conversations with him, kind of active imagination, and he said things which I had not consciously thought. For I observed clearly that it was he who spoke, not I. He said, I treated thoughts as if I generated them myself, but in his view, thoughts were like animals in the forest, or people in a room, or birds in the air, and noted. If you saw people in a room, you would not think that you had made those people, or that you were responsible for them. It was he who taught me psychic objectivity, the reality of psyche. And I did a little homework on Philemon, who was a wealthy, in the ancient sense, he was a wealthy Christian and a leader in the church, and Paul of Tarsus assisted an imprisoned slave, one who had run away from his owner Philemon. And in the letter written by Paul, the prisoner asked for forgiveness. He wanted to return, not as property, he wanted to return as a familial bond, as an equal. So, Philemon is related to the concept of Christian grace, love, forgiveness, and reconciliation. And in much later old age, what we're really interested in, or what we're working toward, is a symbolic life with less emphasis on external material reality. And it's the time of the self's ascension and eclipsing of the ego. And eventually, there comes a surrender of the physical body and life itself. And this is the last dream. Let's see if I put that somewhere. Does somebody have a copy of that? Oh, here it is. Right here. It's on the back of your sheet. It's the last dream that I'll talk about. This is 7 years into the analysis, and this person has been given a terminal diagnosis. And it's the last dream we worked on in the analysis. I've come to the aftermath of a terrible devastation where people have experienced some great destruction. Widespread loss of loved ones, an epidemic? I don't know if it's from war or disease. I think it's disease because most of the mourners are men. I'm being shown what the men are to do to heal their suffering, and it's extraordinary. I think it must be in Japan. Many of the men I visit are Japanese. They're working with utmost care, carving and polishing the bones of their dead wives. The results are breathtakingly beautiful, and I cannot speak when I see them. My eyes are filled with tears and wonder. The men work silently with reverence as they smooth and polish and set precious stones in and bind with strong colored threads of silk the bones of their loved ones. And she had this dream while she was trying to decide what to do with her body when she died. Now, what's remarkable is the first dream that's listed in the front. Her initial dream was of stones on a cord. So here, and you'll see this in an analysis, you'll see the transformation of something into something else, but the theme is continued. The bones are the hardest substance in the human body, and they're the last that are burned through in a cremation. So the bones are the stones of the body. And what happens to those stones from the initial cord is they've now, under great pressure and tremendous work over time, become precious stones. Not just stones, but, you know, like Superman when he held the piece of coal, it turned into a diamond. Well, those stones have now become precious stones that are inlaid in the bones by the men who are grieving. And it's no longer a cord, but it's silk thread. Very delicate, very beautiful. She was an artist, and these are her little drawings. And part of why I share this is because so many of her dreams were gifts that helped her complete her life, that helped her deal with midlife, that helped her deal with tremendous loss. And a dream like this is a direct gift from psyche about how one can manage grief and suffering. And for me, it was an instruction that part of how I could deal with my own grief about ending a long treatment and going through a death with someone, I began to write. And that's when I began to really write, is after the instruction from a dream like this. So we have just a few minutes. I don't know if you have any questions or thoughts, or I know it's Friday night and I can't speak English very good. So, okay. Sleep well, dream well. Thank you. Thank you for coming.